Go ahead. Good afternoon, everybody. We were supposed to have started about, I think 15 minutes ago. And my name is Tom Farrell. I'm the director of the Center for Global Health and Peacebuilding in sort of distributed offices around the world. I'm really honored today, and I'm a member of the board of directors for Alliance for Peacebuilding, and that's how I squeezed myself in here today, I think. But I'm very proud to present Victor O'Chin, my guest to my left and your right. But what's very difficult, just as an introduction, it's very difficult to, once Victor gets in the group, to all of a sudden you feel like you're smaller than life. So this is the reason for the tie today, is just so I have some recognition that I'm here, because he'll take it over rather rapidly. It's really nice from the conference that is from yesterday and what we saw this morning, the range of discussions that we're having in the peacebuilding community, which really reflects the diversity and the problems. But I love this morning's discussion where we began with the military and we ended with Buddha. And I think that scope really represents what we're doing and who we are and our ethics and the problems that we face. The military not being as our partner. I mean, we do need to have personal community security, but, to what? And here, the idea here today is really, what is the personal, I'm going to read a little bit too here. So the personal and community perspective in the human domain, in a conflict and post-conflict region in northern Uganda. Now, Victor O'Chin was born in 1981 and from 1981, for a variety of reasons, he lived in an armed conflict environment. So imagine yourself as a baby, as a child growing up. There was violence and impact of violence all around you every day. Okay, this is what he knows, and he's always quite amazed to be here in Washington. He says, "Look at this." You can imagine the opposite, and that's where Victor came from. So he's from the Obia district in northern Uganda, which is about Lira to the east of Gulu, if you've been in that area. But he covers all of northern Uganda and the work that he does. And not only did he survive living in an internally displaced persons camp, IDP camp, but he also got an education. But he didn't just get an education, he had to work for it. So he had to go out in the bush, in rebel-held areas, make charcoal, sell charcoal, so he could pay for school fees and support his family. His whole family had to do this. So this is, this is his world. At the same time, what was going on periodically, there were villages being burnt, children being killed, people being killed, his friends, schoolmate, and eventually his brother and cousins were abducted and lost contact with them. So you can imagine how very difficult it was and how a very different life. And that's why he's here, to give his perspective. But what's unique about Victor is his mother. His mother, from the very earliest memories of his, always encouraged him to look for options, focused on family, focused on communities, through their church organizations and youth organizations. And they really got involved in that. And that was a way of as we talked about, instilling hope when there is so much despair and violence around. Okay, and it was just a reaction to what was happening. But Victor kept that and has instilled that in his work that we've been looking at, that I'm involved with him. I'm sorry. And what was unique about it, when I first met Victor a couple of years ago, as he always said, there was always this option, My mother talked, there was an option other than picking up the gun, and he was always involved. What are those options? And I don't remember ever asking those questions when I was a teenager, 14. It was a very different set of questions. But Victor, at a very early age, says, what are options other than violence? But now, so you think, that Victor was really a good guy. But there are some very problems with Victor. He was a very truant student. He didn't go to school very much. He didn't attend school. Now, he has this excuse that there was a war and there are lots of schools, but I don't know. I had to walk several miles to school every day, so I know. The difference is that Victor also, when he could walk to school, he didn't have shoes, and so makes us him a little bit more special and the importance of this tie. He did eventually finish primary school at 15 and then recently just finished a bachelor's degree in leadership and development studies at Makerere University in Kampala. So let me just sort of a long summary of then. From a very early age, he chose nonviolence. It's key. Who has those choices in life? Who makes those choices? And how they're instilled in the way he still thinks about the world and sees the world and his dedication to the community. So he'd been working with victims from the 20-year plus war in northern Uganda, starting with Doctors Without Borders. He did some work earlier than that. Then he volunteered to Doctors Without Borders. And then he also became, as I found out, a national personality in a program called Straight Talk. He then organized in 2005 the African Youth Initiative Network, which is now currently the executive director. And we can talk about the mission was to provide psychosocial rehabilitation to the victims in this community, but really focused on a medical rehabilitation, especially in those chronic injury situations that people tend to dump off, most organizations tend to dump off. He focused continuously on it. I mean, his value was the long-term health of the community and the individuals within it. He worked, and so a lot of his, there's other work in democracy and youth leadership. He was funded by the International Criminal Court System program called the Trust Fund for Victims for a while, and now the UN Peacebuilding Fund through the Office of the High Commission for Human Rights and the UNDP, and funding from us, the Center for Global Health and Peacebuilding. He's been very active in his relationships and advocacy and assistance for thousands and thousands of individuals, if you go and visit him in his regions, is just legendary. He was the only African youth leader, resident youth leader, that was invited to the 2011 NATO conference, and where Ban Ki-moon recognized him, the work that he was doing in northern Uganda, which landed him a lunch with the president and a few of his advisors and a few other people, world leaders. He's a Desmond Tutu Fellow for African Youth Leaders, and he's also a fellow with my organization here, in which we've been talking with people in Washington. Now, what I'd like to do with that short introduction, understanding about Victor, is I'm going to ask him a few questions, and I will open it up to the audience, okay? And I think I'll just start with that. Yeah. So, and then at the end, I'll wrap it up, okay? So, hi, Victor. How are you?
I'm good.
So, I have three questions I want to start off with. Okay. And I'm going to ask them in succession, and then we'll open it up. So, if you worked now for years in war-affected communities at that really important interface between the individuals in the community as a whole, and working the fabric of the community, and local and national and international NGOs, in governments and NGOs.
Yeah.
Lots of stories about things that happen between the UN and the government and victims. We can get into that. But basically, first question, what has been your experiences in working with these institutions from a personal perspective? Second part, what have we been doing right? What do you think has been done right? And then where can we improve?
Okay. Yeah. Hello, everybody. As Tom said, that's my name, Victor Ochen. I'm a Ugandan from northern Uganda. I am not based in America. I'm based in northern Uganda. I came down for this meeting, which we are doing now. I'm really excited to meet all of you. As I met Tom also, the first time I met him, he called me. We were conducting reconstructive surgical camps for the victims of war. I remember we had like about 100 people we brought down to the hospital. And we couldn't meet to pay the bill for about 60. So the 40 was supposed to send them back because we couldn't afford to meet their medical bills. So when Tom called me, I told him that we need some money down here to do this work. And we started on a stronger note. I asked for money for him. I said, you have to pay some money so that you can pay these people medical bills so that they don't go back home untreated. So I remember he then said, okay, we have some money. I said, when? I said, come on. The money is available in Uganda, and he gave me a couple of $1,000s. And then we were able to treat about 40 more people who were supposed to go back home without getting any treatment. And from that point, I said, this is a good guy. Thank you, Tom. Yeah.
First impressions could be wrong, you know.
Yes.
We're still waiting.
He asked me a question that I've been working in the community. What have we done right, and how can we improve on a few areas? Well, as someone who was born and raised in the community, it's a situation of daily struggle. I grew up there, was born and raised there. I am not just working in the community, but it's a place where I was born and raised. I saw what is being talked about. I experienced it, and I am part of that rebuilding right now. So I, as Tom said as well, that I didn't really have a phenomenal education like master's, PhDs, whatever you're talking about. But I think I'm happy to be speaking fairly good English today. I might be missing some few S's because I also skipped a number of classes before I was able to move on. So don't mind if it's not spoken well. Hope you'll get that. Yeah, it's a community where you work in. It's about how you connect yourself with the realities. It's not about studying about it or researching on it. But when I saw how things has been going on in the community, I saw how people suffered, people survived. I realized how clearly I could see the resilience in the people in the society. I think what we did right as the civil society organization is, first of all, by coming together to identify ourselves with the victims has been very key. That, in so many ways, facilitated the process of transition from the horrible, hopeless life of atrocities they've been living to a sensible life of hope and confidence. And to the point that I can see now, we have fairly peace in the community, and there is a sense of faith, and that's what people want. Moving away from the darkness of fears and horrors and hopelessness to the light of faith. This is what the civil society internationally and nationally, we've been very instrumental in doing this. With the generous support from people from around the world, this has been very key in terms of identifying ourselves with the society, which we support. That has been key.
So question there. I mean, so I listened to you and I said, okay, Victor's had a hard life and lived in the bush and all that other stuff, but I listen to you a lot, but I still don't, it's still hard for me to grasp what it would be like to live in the bush for several days outside avoiding rebels and not getting captured. I mean, what was that like? What was going...
It's, yes, that's a good question. What life, someone, it's unimaginable that someone can live that life where you sleep in the bush. You struggle with your own security. You forget about education because that's a luxury. And you look at how will I manage to survive abduction today? How will I see my friends who abducted yesterday or were taken away this morning? Will they ever come back? And the most worrying moment was when your mother goes out to look for food, you would be worried whether she would come back, because a lot of the families, a lot of my headmates, saw their parents, their mothers went and they never came back. And this was the most worrying moment. And in a way, it was the most traumatizing period for any child who was growing up in this community. And to the extent that children looked at their parents as they have failed them, yet parents equally were defeated on what else to do. And in so many ways, it left almost no hope on what to do, because you would choose between education, which was not going on, and between maybe abduction, or you choose to join voluntarily the government forces, which was all very challenging. And in this context, like, it made it very easy for the youngest generation. A lot of parents felt that children were burdens because they would demand food, yet they don't have food. And a lot of them lost their lives because in the process of looking for food for their children, to feed their children, it was hard. So growing up in a place where you would eat meat not more than 5 times a year, that is something challenging. No salt, no. Malaria came, and I suffered from malaria to the extent that I became immune to malaria. I don't suffer from malaria anymore. And there were like series of sicknesses that were breaking out. But that, in any way, did not kill the sense of hope which we had in the community. There was still sense of feeling that at one point it would be fine, it would be all right. People were not so sure about where the government was and where the United Nations was. People would ask, where is America? And this was the point. And people didn't have any hope in anything completely except in the feeling that at some point it would be fine. Religious-wise, people were very spiritual. I saw that it sustained the commitment by the local communities, the leaders, the IDP camp leaders, more than the political leaders. I think they worked so well with the religious institution. The churches played a key role in helping create the sense of ownership and feeling for one another in their camps.
So how can we work? You made a comment the other day of one of the things we perspective of how we should approach working with you. And you said, help us, support us to rebuild. You didn't, so which is a different perspective than we're going to come in and do something for you. Actually, it was coming, you used the word support. Can you talk a little bit more about that and that?
From the perspective of a peace builder, I think oftentimes we fail to identify whether peace can be in practice or peace is just concept, we keep it in papers and it remains there. In a way, if we choose to make it practical and we look at peace is, to us, peace is when human suffering ends and may not be completely end, but if you address that human physical and emotional pains, that's when peace from within individual, within the families, within the society, that's how we counted it. And looking at that, if you consider the community you are working with as people who doesn't even, who never read about peace, who never went to school, it will give you opportunity to redesign your approaches in terms of, do you need to make your peace effort in the society more training focused? Whom are you training for what? Or you need to look at how do we ensure we create peace within the individuals who are suffering from the horrible injuries, war injuries, physically, emotionally, and society-wise. So this, in a way, help in thinking how to come practical and create peace, because I saw on many occasions when we provided the medical rehabilitation to the families, to the mothers of the families who are abducted, sexually abused, and I saw a total sense of healing within that person, within their families, within their communities. And this resulted in more practical peace and dignity within the lives of those individuals and in the society. So the question whether should we come in to save or should we come in to, how do we support? My point would be, let's come in to support other than coming with a mentality to come and save. Because much as they have not been able to put in place infrastructure like schools, good roads and all that, but let's count on the small contribution the parents made on the peak of insurgency to support, to feed their children on throughout all these odds and challenges. This is what you can count on, and this is where you can empower someone who has struggled with their life, rather than coming that, okay, I have these holistic, ballistic approaches we have in place, we have researched on these many years. That research is good and brilliant, it helps in informing the policies. But when it comes to practically working with the people, you need to calm down, you need to speak their language, maybe not linguistically, but the heart of feeling, you have to connect yourself with the realities in the situation.
So how community. Do we do that? What have you learned to help us how to do that?
My experience working in northern Uganda, I saw there were tons and tons of international and national NGOs came in. I would say we have been more than grateful for the government-to-government support from international communities, person-to-person, families-to-families. All this created a huge support, and in a way that made it very easy for people to move on. However, I must say, too much presence of the international civil society organization displaces or kills the commitment by the local initiative. On many occasions, because the international NGOs come with a huge amount of money, have heavy machineries, the good vehicles they drive around, and then you, the local initiatives, you are completely displaced. And the only way they can engage, they could engage on many occasions, were organizing one-day workshops, you're giving T-shirts and say, we are building your capacity. I think it's about shifting from the T-shirts focus kind of international intervention to helping put things right in a way that you build the capacity of the local initiative. And I think this has worked quite well with a good number of donors that came in the country. And I want to point out Danida for Denmark has been very practical in a way that for you to get any funding from Danida, whether you're a Danish NGO, you must have clearly a contract or a commitment to work and develop the capacity of the local organization. This has been very successful. The same has happened also with the DFID of the UK. But I think we have been having a bit of challenge with our USAID grant, which has been really good, fantastic. I must say the USAID grant that has been going to the government has been more successful than the one that's been going to the civil society organization, which is the contrary again. If maybe, I remember we tried on many occasions, but we couldn't qualify because we are a local initiative. We don't have like multi-years financial report. We don't have a stronger institution. You know, it makes it very hard for us to qualify. And this has been very demoralizing. And I want to give an example. There was a U.S. Spring program, which went to Uganda. And this is an amazing initiative that came in to do a great work in community peace building. I remember when we approached them and said, can we be supported to provide health and psychosocial support to the victims of these serious human rights violations? And then the response was that, this is peace building fund, your intervention doesn't qualify for this kind of work. I said, come on, what do we do? Until when the UN peace building fund came in and gave us support, as a trial, to try what we are talking about, if it was really making sense, it's a peace-building fund. And how does peace-building translate into physical and emotional and medical rehabilitation of someone whose life has been shattered by war? And when they gave us as a trial, not until very recently, we were named as the best performing NGO under the UN peace-building fund because of what we did, and the results was there, and they saw families recovered, individuals got, you know, repaired and all that. So I must say it became something which at the end of the day, UN and the government came up and say, our initiative was the model community-led reparation initiative, which is something we can count on. The local initiative, we appreciate the international initiative, but we need to work together. We need to build the capacity of the locals so that once they are gone, there can be a replacement. So that has been the situation.
I'd like to open up to the audience then. Do we have a microphone or just... Yeah, please stand up and announce yourself. Or if we don't have a microphone, what organization and your question, and we have microphones. Yeah. Sorry for that surprise. Surprise attack. Yeah, in the back. Yeah. Or... But it's being recorded, so it's important to, yeah.
So much of this conference has been at such a high level of conversation, which is great, but how does that translate down to the ground? I've been working in the field for a while at the ground level, and now I moved to D.C. in the last year and a half, and I must say it's very frustrating. And I want to hear your reaction to this. We spoke yesterday about the Spring Project. The Spring Project was a, I don't know, over $10 million, maybe $20 million peace-building project, USAID funded. If you look online or you look at the final evaluations of that project, they're positive. There's very little critical analysis of that program. But if you ask the gentleman who's from there, the reality, you get a different story. And so how can that be? How can we have that juxtaposition of what's reported here? I mean, $20 million or $50 million, considering our economy right now, is a lot. And how can it be extended when we have this reality on the ground? And so I'd like to hear your comments about that.
So did you know the results of the report and the positives and your view on the ground? Can you comment on that?
Well, as he brought it up, this is a grant meant for peace and reconciliation program in northern Uganda. I think, as I said before, that is not only on Spring, but most of the grants as well that came in. It goes beyond the capacity of the local initiative. So it is really, really hard to tell how much money is allocated for what and how can you be part of the, you know, monitoring and evaluation. So in real, real life situation, it's hard for the local initiative to know how much money is always allocated in that context. So that's why I was saying initially, most of the US aid grant given to the government has been more successful than the one that has been given to the civil society organization because government works with the inline ministries. It takes a lot of time. Probably dies a lot on the way, but at least at some point the results are seen. But these other ones, it's about workshops, trainings, and all that. You know, this is really what is a bit not very clear to many people, to the beneficiaries, doesn't know how much money is given for us and how can we be part of this. And in the process, you may try to look around to establish what can we do. And it is really, really hard to find out who is accountable to who. So if had it been maybe that there was a stronger connection with the local initiative at that planning session or maybe at that implementation and also at the monitoring component, that would have been much better. But I may not have details on how to comment a lot on this. I brought it because we tried it as the local initiatives. And we didn't get it. But I'm not saying it was wrong for us not to get it, but to say it doesn't fit within the peace-building concept, that's where my problem was. It shows how unclear everyone seems in terms of peace. There's no peace, you know, we don't have peace blocks. We have peace in process. How do we create that? How do we make it? How do we realize that? I think this is how we need to really be deeply connected with the realities in the society.
Yes, gentlemen.
My name is Brahanu Mangistu. I'm a faculty member at Old Dominion University. I'm admiringly jealous, those of you who do full-time peacemaking work. Your question to Victor, how do we do it, what do we do, how are we doing this, how question is grabbing, is real for me. It seems to me if we are really going to advance peace, there has been wonderful ideas suggested today, if I may add 1 cent worth. That is, one approach is putting out fires, kind of the firefighters approach, to identify and work on where the fire is, like Victor is doing. A second approach, it seems to me, if we are going to build a culture of peace, is to come up with educational strategy where we can teach people to fish. I think in what was presented today, particularly in the survey that I saw that was reported, which I thought was a wonderful study, and I thought the biggest gap is education. If you remember, those of you who were there when this data was presented, youth training, youth education was the last in every column, regardless which organization was interviewed. So it seems to me, if you are asking how, since I too work in the bushes and walked in the bushes to go to school, The firefighters' approach dealing with the crisis, but also sustainable education, so that we have a culture of peace. That seems to me.
Maybe I can say something before someone makes it. I think we definitely, as international communities, we have the capacity, we have the resources, which is needed to build peace down in the poor communities who are struggling with their acceptance, their, you know, their daily life. And as you say, it takes us back. How do we then fall into the system where we make our resources possible? We don't keep peace in the pocket. How do we take peace to the community? It is a question like, do you need to go down to the community to look for someone with master degrees in peace building to do the work in the community. Because, like, how many has masters in, you know, in peace generally, or have master degrees to do that? In a way, you are technically denying the local opportunities to participate. It doesn't need a degree to build peace. If it needed a degree to build peace, I would not be talking here. And my first time in my capital city was in 2002, which is not so long ago. That shows how it has been hard to struggle growing up in that community where peace was a foreigner. You could see it for one day, the next day it's not there. And it didn't need it to have me acquire highest education. But sometimes I would say, a lot of people say, I probably have PhD in African experience. I may not have PhD in African studies, but I have it in African experience. I saw it, I experienced it, and I'm trying to be part of that great rebuilding. But I did not achieve the world's most powerful education like most of you.
Please, yes. I'm sorry, and then Bob.
Oh, all right.
I'm not quite sure how much more time we have.
A lot.
Victor. The shrinks would call what you have resilience. The anthropologists would call it positive deviance. That is, you got the same lemons everybody else did, but you made lemonade. Okay? If we're implementers and you know what your country needs, how do we take your experience and leverage it in places outside of Lira, like in Kitgum, in Pader, and in Arua?
Yep.
How can we build on what you have?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, that's a very good question. How can we, a kind of resilience I have be supported? And in a way, I would say there are hundreds and thousands of me behind me. I left them in Uganda, and they are there. They're doing a great work. My organization, let me get an example. It takes the heart of practical interventions aimed at healing the society to get many me who are still left in the community. And then, if you do it this way, there are many of us who feels maybe our capacity or our resilience doesn't count, doesn't talk. And we are saying, now that we have the opportunity to talk to the rest of the world, we have the opportunity to network. It's an honor for me to attend this high-powered kind of forum. And then coming down is one thing, but how do we intervene? How do we practically engage with the people? You need the local connections who understand what is going on in the community.
Yeah, but
from issues to needs.
Yeah, because I know where you're going with this. I'm going to interrupt. But he says, what can we learn from you how to make lemonade out of lemons? Because we all have lemons. How would you teach somebody to make lemonade?
Yeah, it's a good question. Tough.
Is that what?
Well, it's not about. I would say it's my experience that made it. I look at it how hard it is for you to experience exactly what I experienced. But I understand when you feel what I went through and you want to count on that and see how it can make many me in the community. And I think your support in all ways is welcomed. Your commitment to expose our situation is based on dignity and respect is welcomed. We don't want an intervention or support that creates more tension. This is what all other support were coming. We need to heal. We need to move on. You help us put behind our back our painful history and focus on the process of a new community of peace and security. This is the techniques you have. You have the resources. Can you help us look for resources? And I'm saying, if we, assuming in northern Uganda, we prioritize on how many people are still in need for treatment for war-related wounds, war-related injuries. It doesn't take many million dollars. It takes something little. to do this. And I would even say, let's not make it open-ended campaign. Let's focus in the next 24 months. Can we afford to raise $1 million to treat about 10,000 people who are still in critical medical needs? This is what we are saying. And we are saying, you have the resources, you have the knowledge, you know who does this. This is what we need from you. Come and help us translate this, resilience we have in order to support. I'm happy. Recently, the Center for Global Health supported us in the community memorial services. It's about healing. We brought on together in this community where over 300 people were killed in a day. We brought people from different massacre spots to stand together for the first time. At night, you see over 1,000 people lighting their candle in the community, singing and standing together for reflecting for 1 hour. This is when the community felt, at last, we are celebrating the peace which was hardly won. And we have to set up the goals. And people are saying, let's put up a monument of peace. This is going to be a symbol that peace has finally returned in our community. Never to go away. We are going to sustain the legacy we have brought. So this is something representative. And people are saying, help us, support us in a way that we can rebuild the infrastructure shattered by the war, because we see the bullet scars on these walls. And that's why we are saying, come with the little support you have. Let's count on the resilience in the society. And let's work together, build the capacity of the local initiative. This would help in a way.
Then you. Go ahead. Yeah, it's working.
Hello. This is Michael Shodipor from Kano, Nigeria. I want to commend Victor for what he's doing, because I really know and I understand what he's talking about, because we almost have, how will I put it, we step on the same shoes, because we also have a similar experience in Nigeria. But what I want really to ask Victor is this. Knowing very well that knowledge, zeal without knowledge, I know it's not enough. How do you, because I want to ask based on what's happening now in Nigeria, because what we thought can never happen in our country, looking at probably Afghanistan, Iran, issue of bombing, but it has come home. Every day now we wake up, bombs everywhere, especially in Kano where I live. And I know you have that experience of war, which we don't have. Or, well, I would say we had, but we don't have such experience. So how do you recruit your staff or people that work with you? Because I know you can't do it alone. It's not something you can do. It's not your own a lone ranger. You have to have people that have the same mind, have the same vision like you. So how were you able to probably mobilize people to work with you? And then, because I know, like in Nigeria, people see most of us doing this kind of work as if it's for jobless people. People don't have work. And that's why when you said DVID and all these international agencies come, next thing they will just know they're employed. They see people like us as wasting our time. What are you doing? How do you sustain yourself? It's like you don't know what you are doing. So how do you recruit people to work with you? How do you get them along? Because I know you can't do it alone.
Yeah, that's a good one. In my country, I experienced on many occasions when a lot of people show his interest to come and work with us. But getting to do the actual work, someone will not take long or run away, because we do practical, severe emotional work every day. It's more disturbing sometimes when some of our patients we support are requested to get out of the public buses because their injury smells. And this is the kind of work. And being exposed to this horrible, seeing, witnessing this painful situation, hearing these horrible stories every day is quite traumatizing. You may not like it as a young person. But again, I must say, what I started small as an individual, we now have 25 staffs who are really motivated. These are young people. Not all of them are young, but young in spirit. And also, in so many ways, I would say they are not paid salaries as such, but they are motivated for the little work they do. You see their dedication, their commitment. I want to give a story of one of my staffs who is a special staff to me. I was one time doing a community interview, documenting the histories as a former child soldier, how he struggled, where he is right now, just to find that he told the story to the point that I realized he was one of the kids who was commanded to tie my own brother, who was abducted, and he has never come back. So, getting to the point that he did that, I almost lost, but I controlled myself for a lot of minutes. To the extent that I went back home, I never told any of my family members that I found a kid who was commanded to tie my own brother, who has never come back up to now. I was struggling with it. How do I go over this? Not to tell any of my family members, not even tell this kid that he did this. But at the end of the day, the only way for me to get over this suffering of with this feeling was to bring him on board. And we're working together. He doesn't know that.
And so you can't, you can't tell him, you can't reveal.
I know you don't know them. He does not know that, but I know it myself. None of my family members know. But bringing him on board was a huge reconciliation for me to move on, to forget about him. So that is a very tangible example of one staff we recruited. But there are many, we make public announcements and people come in, and we have so many formerly abducted kids who are working with us. And you don't need to look for highly trained people to do this work. You need to look at those who can really connect with the communities and with the real situation. Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, Victor.
And then Bob.
Hello.
Bob, you're next.
We work in northern Uganda. We run 4 mental health clinics at district hospitals in Gulu, Kitgum, Arua, and Soroti. Mm. And you are exactly the people that we want to work with. We feel that we are there to do what is needed in your country and what is wanted by your people, not to bring our own ideas in. We only work with Ugandans. All the people who work in our clinics are not only Ugandans, but they are Acholis when we're in Acholi land. We have a narrow focus. We deal with mental health. We don't deal with physical health. But you are exactly the kind of person and group that we would want to partner with. I mean, we can't come in and give you money for your group, but we can partner with you and include all of the people that you work with to be seen, first of all, not only at our clinics for free, because all of our clinics are completely free, but we are also in the process now of reaching down, I think I had told you, to the level 2 health centers in the communities. And you are the perfect person to help us reach the people that need the help. We do the training. We pay the salaries of the people that see the patients. We work with your government. We have a memorandum of understanding with the Ugandan government, and we would delight in being able to have the privilege to contact you and to work with you in Uganda. It's not that we're in a position to just, you know, as you were, to hand him money to do his work, because that's not our mission, but certainly to partner. So,
thank you so much. Thank you so much. I'm glad to hear you're working in northern Uganda. I look forward to that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I want to thank both of you for this stirring occasion to show you how rapidly the community has evolved. I think 3 years ago, a mid-level Army officer in uniform came to one of our annual meetings and was looked upon as kind of a horse in the cathedral, perhaps. And here we've had, now I'm going to even quote approvingly the principal deputy assistant secretary of defense who spoke, who said we ought to make sure that we've got the problem identified correctly. So if we're talking about what knowledge should an NGO have in working with a counterpart NGO, that's one level of knowledge that's extremely important. But if you talk about the NGO community as a whole, then the community and the donor community as well had better have the political analysis correct. And I'm not even sure now even whether the external community has the political analysis correct. There was a very interesting article in the Washington Post a couple months ago about the LRA. Where is it? Mm-hmm. What threat does it have anymore? We rarely talk about what threat does the national government of Uganda pose for the northern government, and how does one cope with that. So how does one get that kind of knowledge without, you know, the delicacy of the political arrangements that you have to have both as a citizen and as somebody being honest with outside sources? How does the NGO community as a whole better understand the situation they're getting into?
Yeah, thank you so much. I must say you brought a very good point recently about Konyi 2012. I know most of you knew Uganda because of either Idi Amin or recently about Konyi 2012. And I got caught up in the middle of that. As soon as the movie was released, I got caught up immediately because people know we work with the victims and we are the people who are rightly positioned where the victims are. Upon seeing over 15 million people already made a debate, their own analysis, perspective, blaming someone, doing what, and then when we gave our perspective, I gave mine, and I think I felt it started guiding the global debate towards the victims' need, towards the real problems in the community, not just an individual, not just focusing on the perpetrator, whom to many victims it doesn't seem relevant as long as their life moves on. So when we did this, we felt the victims' communities were being talked about, but they have no access to electricity, no TV, no internet, so they had no idea what the world was talking about them. So when we screened the movie, my organization did screen the movie, this was an opportunity to empower the community so that they know what the world is talking about them and also they give their perspective. So the response, if you saw ad about stone throwing, people were unhappy, people were outraged, I was there when they were doing that. And we facilitated giving the community a chance to do that. We learned a lesson from that. My impression, which I think, as you said, politically, do we understand things, is sometimes the world doesn't seem to tell the positive stories of the situation. People want to always present, what's that ugly part of the situation? I'll tell you a story about a kid asking me, are you really from Africa? I'll tell you shortly after this. So when this came up, finding that the community themselves feels they worked so hard to see the peace they are having right now in northern Uganda. But in so many ways, the movie, the film did not appreciate, did not represent the realities of what exactly was going on and what had happened to see the community to where they are right now. And then that's why the community are outraged to see this coming up. And secondly, looking at, are we after the negative report or we are after counting on the small contribution the community has made in a way that we can move on? Looking at how community had to recruit their own sons and daughters to fight alongside the UPDF, the government troops, that led to flashing of the LRA from Uganda to another country. And so far, we have even UPDF following them right now in Sudan, in Congo, in Central African Republic. This is a commitment that we have to appreciate. I don't think in any way a regime change alone would bring total peace in northern Uganda or would bring change in the country. We need to, what led to what we are seeing right now, this is what we need. And again, we're looking at the perspective of the victims as someone who suffered there. No one wants to hear about war anymore. And people are saying, before you advocate for military intervention, what priorities have you put in place to make sure you protect those kids who are in captivity? What about the families of those missing family members? Konyi would be even killed tomorrow. And what if the other family members doesn't turn up? What will happen? So we are saying, prepare the community, prepare the victims, ensure what you're doing targets at healing, rather than in a way that hurts.
So what is the political environment now compared to 5 years ago? Has it improved to achieve what you're talking about, or not?
Yes. Right now, there is no active war going on in northern Uganda. The government of Uganda came up with a framework resulting from the peace agreement, which is called Peace Recovery and Development Plan. This is to guide the intervention, all both national and international intervention, to guide on how do we identify ourselves with the real situation, reconciliation, peace building, development. And every intervention must align themselves with one of the objectives. So I think this is a political commitment from the government of Uganda. Much as we are looking at how to make sure that we represent the other side of the government, it is very important that they are not covered. But also it's very important to know that without the people believing in that the communities can change the leadership in Kampala, it will not bring a total healing. So definitely government should be held accountable for what they have done, their inactions or their actions. And most importantly, communities should be empowered in a way that will not lead to any reoccurrence of such situation. So there's a political will from the government. Mm-hmm. There are issues of accountability, which they are struggling with. There is a component of reparation has come up, which the government is on board. The civil societies are on board, and even the community are on board.
So this is interesting because one of the stories you've told me was about this lady who, during a New Year celebration, was attacked and raped by Ugandan soldiers, thrown over a hill, and was left for dead. And she survived, and they took her. So I think this represents the role of civil-based organizations in building peace within communities. So tell us what happened.
Yeah, one of the ladies we supported, she lost her son, was taken. He has never come back. He was a businessman before he was taken. And then this lady had retained bullets in her tummy for the last 10 years. And she's been going through, she was sexually abused as well. And all along, she had not seen any hope completely. But when we facilitated our rehabilitation with the Peace Building Fund, which I'm very grateful.
Is this the same lady that was held by the army?
Yes.
Okay, so that's right. They were the army held her.
Okay. There are many ladies. So.
Oh yeah.
So this is one, and then this other one said, when we operated her, she came and said, this was like 2 days to Christmas, and then she said, for the first time, I'm going to celebrate Christmas without pains, without feeling that I am useless, and you have given me the best Christmas gift ever. And even my son would return one day and appreciate you. And he said, at last, I feel I have peace in me. This was her statement. And in a way, to relate on what he is bringing up, we had a case where a government soldier was accused of having sexually abused a civilian as well. And then in that process, the UN came very strongly to follow up the case with the government, which they did so well. Exposing that, bringing it, ensuring that the government conducted all the possible trials within their military setup. And there was a huge diplomatic ties between the United Nations and then the government on what should happen in terms of accountability. Not until when the UN called us and said, we want you to come and help us intervene on this. Provide our medical support. When we tried, the government tried to push us, and then the United Nations was pushing us. We were caught up in the middle, and our focus was on the lady. So finally, as Tom was saying, what role can civil society play in mediating between diplomatic tensions? We got this lady, you know, at last, and she's receiving medical support right now out of a very restricted government military setup with less diplomatic tensions here and then, which could affect in so many ways, many circumstances. So, as she said, I think it's key if civil society can step in to intervene where necessary. We don't need to. It's also sometimes clear that some of the civil societies are not civil a lot in their attitudes because they differ. They have their own interests as well. So it's good to be civil enough also, even when you differ, and still focus on what brings you there and what makes you feel you are civil enough.
So what I found was very important with the long story, the long version of this, is that UN officials and government officials failed. Bringing Victor in, and they had to leave the room, you know, and left completely. You continued a negotiation with the commander, who you developed trust with, and understood that you would make it a political situation, and then the lady was released and got proper treatment and is part of this fund. So civil-based organizations can play a large role in the community to do this, and we have to recognize this. And we shouldn't just say, always the government. Always the government. It's not. Okay. We're a couple minutes past. I thank you very much for being here. I know I was afraid that everybody would be very sleepy, you know, having postprandial hypersomnolence, but I think that everybody stayed awake. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening. Good, thank you.